Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. The podcast you're about to hear was recorded in 2011.
Wow, what a wonderful afternoon. I'm Jody Fenton, and I manage special collections here in the Seattle Public Library. And it's wonderful, wonderful to see you all here this afternoon. I hope that after this presentation, and after you have a chance to see the exhibit and talk to these authors, that you'll go up to level 10 and look at some of the treasures we have in the Seattle Room. This spring, the Library Board of Trustees adopted a new strategic plan for the library, which includes the importance of local history. And our search for a new city librarian is nearing completion. The board expects to make its decision in May and have our new leader here in the summer. We asked for input from every corner of our community because we wanted our plan to reflect your ideas for the future. Thank you for helping with this draft and what I think is going to be the best strategic plan this institution has ever had. And I say that having studied the history of this institution for many years, so I am really excited about the future. Programs like this one is the result of much hard work, and there are a few thank yous in order. I'd like to thank the Seattle Public Library Foundation for hosting the reception and helping with the organization of this event. Our foundation director, John Ward, and the assistant director, Sharon Griggins, have been very, very supportive to us. Libraries, events, and services facility departments work behind the scenes to coordinate the many tasks that are needed to produce a program like today. And we have Chris in the AV booth helping out to make sure we have a very successful program. Elliott Bay Books has been a longtime bookseller partner for us, has helped to offer you an opportunity to purchase important books, and we're happy to have their support here today as well. The University of Washington Press has for decades given us great books, perfectly edited and beautifully designed about our region and areas beyond. Pat Soden, the director, and Marilyn Trueblood, I know Marilyn's here today, of the press, have a talented and dedicated staff, and they bring to us they help us achieve our literary dreams. This afternoon, we are in the presence of four authors who have come to share highlights and observations about the civil rights era in Seattle. Joan Singler was a founding member of Seattle CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. Jean Durning joined CORE when she moved to Seattle in 1959. Betty Lou Valentine joined in 1964, and Maid Adams joined in 1962. Their Seattle of 1960 was very different from what we know today. There were no black bus drivers, no black sales clerks, or bank tellers. Most African Americans lived in the Central District, perhaps by choice, but also because Seattle neighborhoods had written covenants that prohibited racial integration. Children attended schools that reflected this segregation. Joan, Jean, Betty Lou, and Maid have not only written about CORE, they were a proactive force for this racial equality that we so treasure. We owe you, our community's gratitude, for your work to make Seattle a very different city from the one you saw in 1960. Please join with me in welcoming our presenters.
Good afternoon, welcome, and thank you for coming here today, and also thank you, Jody, and the Library Foundation for hosting us today. My name is Joan Singler, and I am one of four authors of Seattle in Black and White, the Congress of Racial Equality, and the Fight for Equal Opportunity. The other three authors sitting to my left are Jean Durning, Maid Adams, and Betty Lou Valentine. Tonight, we want to share a brief summary of the book with each author giving a short overview of a section of the book, and then we would like to leave time for questions. For those of you who have purchased a book and would like to have it signed, we will be happy to stay after the program to do that. A footnote before we begin. In the book and in our presentation today, we want to take you back to the 1960s, and particularly the language of that time. So you will hear us use the word Negro, and then as time and language changed, you will hear us use Black or Afro-American. Our book is the history of the Seattle chapter of the Congress of Racial Equality, known as CORE, the projects we undertook in the civil rights struggle, and the many dedicated people who were part of that struggle. It is also our combined memoirs of that period when we were all deeply involved. Nonviolent passive resistance has proven to be a very powerful force for change. Gandhi proved that in India's struggle for independence. Rosa Parks proved that when she refused to give up that seat on the bus. Negro students in North Carolina who refused to leave a lunch counter until they were served proved that. And CORE freedom riders in Anniston and Montgomery, Alabama proved that when they endured the firebombing of their bus and the beatings they received trying to integrate a bus station in the South. With the burning of the bus and the horrendous beating suffered by the freedom riders, the question was, could this continue? James Farmer, national director of CORE and a freedom rider, was not ready to back down. He caught the attention of Americans when he asked for a continuation, not a retreat, in this challenge. His call to action was answered by hundreds of citizens, students, clergy, housewives, doctors, people from all walks of life who risk their personal safety to end segregation and became freedom riders. The challenge to join this movement and become a freedom rider was heard here in Seattle by Ray Cooper, a 19-year-old white art student. But Ray had challenges of his own. He had no way of getting to the South. At a chance meeting with Ray Cooper, Ken Rose, Norman Johnson, Ed Singler, and myself, a plan took shape. We would raise the money to get Ray to New Orleans, where he was trained in nonviolent passive resistance, and then he indeed took a freedom ride to Jackson, Mississippi. He also served 47 days in Parchment Prison in Mississippi for trying to integrate a Greyhound bus station. Ray's complete story as a freedom rider is included in the book. While raising money for CORE's Freedom Ride project, challenging segregation and bigotry in the South, the remaining four friends knew it was time to address segregation and bigotry right here in Seattle. Even though there was an active chapter of the NAACP in Seattle that provided help and later became an active partner in the struggle for equal opportunity, we were drawn to CORE's approach. We felt connected because of our commitment to the freedom rides. And we believed if direct action using nonviolent passive resistance could work in the South, surely it could work in the North. It wasn't long before we were put to the test. Seattle CORE grew rapidly from that small group to a well-organized, trained cadre of Negroes and whites that were determined to do something about discrimination in housing, in schools, police brutality, and we felt the most important, employment. Before I hand the microphone over to Betty Lou Valentine, who's going to tell you where we started on our search for jobs in Seattle, I want to make 2 points. One is that our book covers the fact that we were under the constant watch of the FBI and Seattle Police Department. With recent access to FBI files, including my FBI file, we learned that 2 informers were recruited from our circle of friends who reported back to the FBI on every activity and every meeting that took place from 1961 to well beyond the end of CORE in 1968. In reading the book, you will also discover that we quickly learned how to raise money. We became instant producers with a fundraising event starring Dick Gregory and Dizzy Gillespie. We filled the Moore Theater with people who were willing to pay $3 for the best seat in the house. The following year, in 1963, we sponsored James Baldwin at the Egyptian Theater. Ticket prices here were $2 for adult and $1 for student, and we raised more than $2,000, sending 99% of those dollars to National CORE for projects in the South. I'm now going to turn the microphone over to Betty Lou. Thank you.
Hello. I'm going to talk about just 3 of the negotiations that Seattle CORE had with employers. We actually negotiated with dozens and dozens of places, some of which you will recognize and remember, Frederick & Nelson, Best, Nordstrom, the Bond, employers like the Darigold and companies of that sort, taxi companies, etc. The 3 I've chosen are, first, a supermarket that was one of our first activities and one of our most successful, quickly successful ones. The second is an employer also that took us many years to negotiate with and to have any success, and which led us to a new tactic. And the third was an attempt to boycott all of downtown Seattle. So, to put you in the mood for this, I want to take you back to 1959. I came to Seattle in the fall of 1959 and found an essentially segregated city. This is before I-5, before Seattle Center. Seattle was on the cusp of being a small town, big city. One of the things that was clear was that there were no signs that said "for colored only." It was a benign segregation. But the following was true. If you were white, you could live, with a few exceptions, in an all-white neighborhood. You rode buses and taxis driven by white men. At the supermarkets and the department stores, you were waited on by a white clerk, and your packages, newspapers, and milk were delivered by a white driver. This was the world. If you were Negro, you worked at odd jobs as a janitor, a maid, a dishwasher, a handyman, although there were some exceptions, professionals who largely served the Negro community as doctors or lawyers, real estate, or who worked for the federal government or at Boeing. No matter what your occupation, you lived in the central area, a 4-census-tract area, which remained the same size even when the population doubled. You shopped daily for milk and groceries from all-white clerks, cashiers, produce workers, and butchers. In some supermarkets in the central area, Negroes made up a majority of the shoppers. So with this potential base for action, CORE began its work to educate the community. Don't shop where you can't work was one of our slogans, and our attempt was to get jobs for Negroes at living wages. Our other slogan was, don't cross the freedom line. We followed the CORE rules for action that required us to investigate. But in those days, remember, it was kind of an 8-to-5 world. You didn't have 24-hour supermarkets. So we stood at the employee entrance and just counted the employees as they walked in. With our results in hand, we asked to meet with someone high enough to make decisions about policy. And this began the negotiation phase, which often went on for months and in some cases for years. Our first supermarket direct action was against the Safeway store at 23rd and Union. Within 2 days of picketing, Safeway sent its regional director to promise action. And it was 16 months later that Safeway hired 28 Negroes. The A&P, no longer a Seattle presence, was the supermarket I grew up with in Pittsburgh. And I was happy to be on the negotiating team with that company. Our first contact with A&P was in 1962, when they had one Negro employee, and a year later, in 1963, they had, want to guess, how many?
15.
Two! Two Negro employees. It took A&P a year to add one Negro. And it was not until 2 years later that the A&P was up to 9 employees, Negro employees, citywide. This rate was unacceptable. So in 1964, CORE planned a shop-in. For the shop-in, CORE recruited many supporters to take shopping carts and to go around the store, filling them with non-perishable items. Non-perishable was important. Choice items were baby foods, because when they had to be restocked, they had to be put back in specific categories, carrots versus something. And the other was shoe polish. Remember shoe polish? Shoe polish came in a variety of colors. Anyway, we picked items that it would be hard or time-consuming to restack. The shoppers would go through the checkout process where the cashier had to hand enter the cost of each item. There were no electric swipes then. Remember when you had to punch in the item? And had to figure out how much to charge for a single, say, 3-for-89-cent item. The cashier and the box boy, both white, would load the groceries into bags and put them in the cart. At that point, the shoppers, who were black, white, male, female, young, old, would ask the store about its hiring policy and decide that he or she didn't want to buy discrimination. And it was all absolutely legal. The store could only put the cart aside, and no other shopper could use it, and eventually, all of the items had to be reshelved. We shopped in at the U District A&P with the help of the campus civil rights organ group, CRAG, and we shopped in on Broadway at Rainier and Empire. A&P finally hired Negro employees at all of its 15 stores. While CORE, the Urban League, and the NAACP took part in ongoing actions with many employers, it became clear that we needed a larger presence and that we needed to let the wider community know what was going on. So in 1963, Seattle had its first citywide civil rights march. Although we savored our victories, employment progress was slow, and this led Seattle CORE to develop a project called the Drive for Equal Employment in Downtown Seattle, or DEEDS. After an intensive investigation that involved major resources such as the Census Bureau information, business projections, material from the Washington State Board Against Discrimination, CORE entered negotiations with the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, and the chamber promised, but then canceled, with no explanation, a jobs fair. So CORE decided to undertake a boycott of all of downtown Seattle. Unlike our earlier action, our allies, the NAACP and the Urban League, endorsed the goals of DEEDS, yet refused to support the direct action. CORE moved ahead for 4 months with roving picket lines, a weekend bus to transport people to other shopping areas, car signs, lawn signs, all of the other tactics that we had learned up to this point. Despite all of this, we didn't make the impact that was needed, and in January of 1965, the membership voted to suspend the downtown project. From our perspective, decades later, CORE seems both naive and audacious in undertaking such a giant goal. That we tried is testimony to our enthusiasm, our commitment, and our frustration at the slow pace of achieving equal racial opportunity in employment.
I am Jean Durning. I'm going to talk about a couple of chapters in our book that relate to housing and housing discrimination. On this map, one dot represents 25 African Americans, and as Betty Lou and Jody had indicated, the Negro community was overwhelmingly restricted to the central area, increasingly crowded, with housing increasingly deteriorating. These restrictions were mainly because of white prejudices and realtors' practices. Here's an example. I should say that there were a couple of realtors who were good guys, but basically the real estate industry and the apartment operators were pretty much the villains of this era. One example is a bill that was proposed in the legislature in Olympia, and the Apartment Operators Association sent back a letter to its members warning that if this bill passed, it would compel you to rent to non-white persons who could be prostitutes, criminals, and otherwise dangerous to you and your tenants. And unless you could prove these activities, you couldn't evict them. Other people had other perspectives, and there were some major efforts to open up individual housing in other parts of the Seattle area. African-American families, they felt, should have the same chance at the American dream as everyone else, white picket fence or whatever. This is a brochure for the Fair Housing Listing Service, one of the efforts that sprang up to help black families buy homes outside of the central area. CORE cooperated with the organizations that were supporting this, and we passed out this brochure and other sources of information all over the central area to publicize this listing service, but that's in the book. Individual house-by-house efforts would take forever to open real estate choices. CORE decided to take on the real estate industry. Realtors and apartment operators were actively spreading prejudiced ideas, claiming that one black owner on a block would lower everybody's property values, mailing postcards to white homeowners that said, "You have a right to select your neighbors." Corps formed a housing committee under Joan Singler, and they investigated and they were to take action. First, testing. A white couple and a black couple would go to the same real estate agent, and even though their situations were very similar, they were treated drastically differently. Another core project targeted open houses. You know, when a realtor wants to sell your house, there's a sign that's put out on some weekend. Everybody is invited to stop by and see if you'd like to take a look at this house. Well, we planned for one particular weekend when we urged African-American couples to go outside the central area and look at open houses, just to go window shopping. The Seattle Real Estate Board reacted with ads that this project has been deliberately planned by a nationally organized group. The actual group was five people with Joan Singler, who was pregnant at the time and had a two-year-old at home. the ad continued, "Persons who have no intention whatsoever of purchasing a home serve no purpose other than to disrupt and invade the homes of powerful citizens." Of peaceful citizens. Though some of them were maybe had some power. The head of the real estate board was quoted as saying, "There are all indications that a number of people have been shipped in to guide this demonstration. If these demonstrators are imported, they won't be too concerned with how outrageous they get." Realtors were so distressed at the idea of potential black people looking at houses that all the real estate ads were pulled out of the two newspapers for that weekend. Most brokers, almost all of brokers' offices were closed, and the open houses were all canceled. There were very few remaining open houses. Realtors were just blinded by their own misperceptions. They were unable to comprehend that there were fair-minded people, white and black, in Seattle who cared very much about injustice in housing. All this work by the industry was documented by CORE, and we sent our findings to officials, to reporters, and community leaders. We got almost no response. What we needed was a change in the law. These efforts were after years of work by the NAACP and many others trying to get the city, at least, to pass an ordinance that would outlaw discrimination, just to require that housing could be available anywhere in the city to anyone who had the money. But there was just postponement of action, one thing after another, excuses and study committees and so on. Finally, in 1963, they started hearing, well, things came to a head. There had been hearings. This here is Tim Martin testifying at one of these hearings. He later was a chairman of CORE. Looks to us as though this was mostly real estate people in the audience. At least they're all professional looking. He testified that after a year and a half of frustrating search for a home for his family, he finally found a willing seller near Bellevue. Tim told of driving at night to sign his contract, and to ensure that the seller didn't back out, he carried his down payment with him in cash. There were many stories of this sort. Finally, the city council, after long delays, passed an ordinance that would ban discrimination in rental or sales of housing. But they put it in as a referendum so that Seattle citizens would have to vote on whether discrimination would be illegal. CORE swung into action, our only political campaign. We and many other fair-minded people joining the active black community, distributing brochures, we spoke out, we marched. Archbishop Connolly led a major effort of the Catholic Church. Fair housing, he said, was key to solving other racial inequalities in our society. This was a question not just of justice, but of morality. A large number of Protestant churches sponsored almost 1,000 coffee parties on a Sunday before the election, urging people to vote yes. CORE and others leafleted, including downtown at the end of work. But white fears were fanned by ads from the Seattle Real Estate Board and the Apartment Operators Association, like this one. Would you like a criminal record because you sold your home to a person of your own choice? A similar flyer warned renters of a $500 fine or jail if you were accused of moving out because your landlord rented to a person of a different color than your own. Well, many white citizens' deep qualms could not be overcome. On election day, more than 54,000 people voted in favor of the Fair Housing Ordinance, but twice as many voted against. Seattle voted by 2-1 to continue segregated housing. CORE returned to direct action. We demonstrated at a big real estate firm, picketing for many months and sitting in the offices. This is Betty Lou. You have to read about that in chapter 6.
How is the sound up there at the top? Can you hear me okay? All right. I don't trust these mechanical devices. My name is Maid Adams, and in the book you will see the name Jean Adams, which is my middle name and the name and what I was using at that time. I'm going to touch briefly on two CORE projects and lastly on the ending of CORE. The first project I'm going to talk about is the Seattle school boycott and the Freedom Schools, probably the most dramatic, controversial, and publicized of the CORE projects. CORE, the Urban League, and the NAACP had tried for years to work with the school district to integrate the schools and submitted multiple plans to achieve this, but had no cooperation. The district felt that their, quote, wasn't a problem. In February of 1966, we decided that the only way to get their attention was a citywide school boycott, and began work that involved 2 days of Freedom Schools, March 31st, think how many years ago that was, and April 1st, 1966. What we were doing was not popular or well understood. While some churches, especially the Catholic Church, supported our efforts, a group of downtown ministers objected to the boycott, quote, as exploiting children, and this would foster disrespect of the law, unquote. To which Reverend John Adams, pastor of First AME, replied, I remind these custodians of the status quo that these schools against which we boycott have been illegal for 12 years and they have never said a mumbling word, unquote. Planning for the Freedom Schools meant acquiring 14 sites, mainly in central area churches and community centers, planning curriculum from the first grade through high school, and recruiting hundreds of volunteers. We did all of this in a mere 42 days. Amazing for such an immense task. I was co-principal with Frenchie Adam, a black woman, at First AME Freedom School, grades 1-6. On Thursday, March 31st, to our delight and amazement, eager children began bounding up the steps of First AME an hour early. 2/3 of them were black and 1/3 were white. Freedom Schools were filled to overflowing this first day with more than 3,000 attending. The boycott was an overwhelming success. And this is a shot of Roberta Byrd at the Central Area YMCA. The day included Negro history, science, stories, music, and art taught by volunteers, black and white, from the community, such as Floyd Standifer, Overton Berry, and Henry Siegel, concertmaster of the Seattle Symphony. Mike Rosen of the ACLU is shown here with high schoolers. We went home jubilant and came back the next day to do it all over again with even more students coming, nearly 4,000. We were rewarded by comments from parents, such as the mother who reported her children, quote, came home with a new sense of pride in being Negro and a new knowledge of the part that Negroes have played in America, unquote. One man appeared unannounced both days to spend 6 to 8 hours cleaning up before going to his regular night shift job. He said his children had benefited so much from attending Freedom Schools that he wanted to show his appreciation. Absenteeism in some central area schools was over 50%. We had been able to involve nearly 4,000 students for 2 days in a peaceful, creative protest that taught valuable lessons in neglected history to students happy to learn in an integrated setting. We had sent a clear message to the school board. The district's response over time included a number of actions we had asked for years. Paid transportation for transfer students, training for staff at receiving schools, inclusion of Negro history in the curriculum, Negroes hired in administrative positions, and sensitivity training on race and culture. Later, views on the importance of integrating the schools changed, with some white parents resisting and some black parents tired of having their children bearing the brunt of social change. Schools, as we know, are still a challenge. This is a photo of the crosstown bus ribbon cutting in September of 66. The crosstown bus is one of the most enduring, practical, and visible legacies of Seattle CORE's many efforts. Now known and taken for granted as the number 48, a north-south route from the central area to the university district. Prior to 1966, anyone living in the central area had to first take a bus downtown Seattle, to downtown Seattle, and then transfer to another bus to get to jobs and classes in the U district. In June of 66, a crosstown bus committee organized by CORE and the Central Area Motivation Program, with the support of numerous organizations in the community, began negotiations with the transit company. They said there was, quote, no need and no one would ride, unquote. After 6 months and a threat of a boycott, they agreed to a trial run. Such a major achievement in such a short time, only 6 months, was due in part to previous efforts by the community, and it shows how effective community action can be. Remembering that there are still groups in South Seattle trying to get more adequate bus service. Lastly, Black power. Two words that until the mid-60s were seldom spoken in the same sentence. A revolutionary idea that took the racial lexicon to a new level in terms of self-identity. Colored to Negro to Black, unquote. Written by, that was a statement from Betty Lou Valentine. So what happened to this powerful, effective action group that while we did not achieve everything we wanted to, did make a significant difference in Seattle? How and why did it fade away in 1968? Remember, it was a time of multiple radical revolutions in our country. The anti-Vietnam War movement, the rise of Black power, women's movement, great boycott, peace movements were all new. People like Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, and Elijah Muhammad were offering attractive other ways and reasons for doing things. It was the end of an era focused on civil rights and integration, and the dawn of an era of insistence on Black identity and self-determination. The poverty programs also started in 1965 and addressed a lot of the same challenges of jobs, housing, and education that CORE had been dealing with. And they were able to do that with paid staff. We lost a lot of Black members to these programs, which benefited these groups but depleted our ranks. An example was Walt Huntley, who had been CORE chairman, but was hired when he was hired to create the Central Area Motivation Program. With less clear direction, fewer active members, and less money, the group was depleted but did not realize this. The turning point came at the 1967 National CORE Conference in Oakland, when the Constitution was changed from the definition of CORE as a multiracial organization to, quote, CORE is a mass membership organization to implement the concept of Black power for Black people, unquote. Self-determination as expressed by Black power became the overriding direction. Integration was no longer a goal of CORE. This change in policy caused a rift in the Seattle CORE group and led to the impeaching of the chairman. The March 1968 CORE newsletter carried the headline, quote, CORE All Black, with the statement that, quote, in order for CORE to function in the community, it must be an all-Black organization. It was agreed by most of the people there that this was the best thing, unquote. As the tone of this quotation indicates, the separation was not done with anger or hostility, but as a practical matter. Most whites in the organization were shocked at this turn of events. Some were saddened and some angry. Most became involved in other action groups such as the peace or women's movements or the Great Boycott. In CORE's final months, various combinations of African Americans met to try to fill the void left from impeaching the chairman, the loss of significant Black leadership to local poverty programs, and a general loss of energy due to major changes in direction. An interim all-Black governing committee of Ed Russell, Ira Oaks, Barbara Davis Robinson, and Bob Redwine were met to outline Black power goals. It is apparent in looking back that the organization began a slow death around 1966. In part, we were surviving on momentum from previous successes. People took jobs, moved out of the area, became involved in other groups. One analyst of the era put it this way, quote, as is often the case in social movements, especially radical movements, one generation of activists often gives way to another, unquote. In Seattle, too, changing times required a different relevancy. CORE faded away sometime in 68 due to lack of continuity of leadership, money, and participants, and also due to powerful changing times. CORE's ending marked the passing of an era and the birth of a new one. I will leave you with these thoughts. As early as 1963, through negotiation and direct action, Seattle CORE produced 250 jobs for African Americans, more in that time period than any federal, state, or city agency concerned with racial discrimination. And that's not all the jobs that we produced, but that was during a particular time period in 1963. Most of these represented jobs that were breakthroughs in categories and with better wages. Also, one author observed that in the post-60s, civil rights activism took new forms. Quote, thousands of Blacks were elected to office in northern cities, an unprecedented shift in the color of local and national politics. Unprecedented numbers of Blacks served on city councils, school boards, local and federal courts, and as mayors. The shift in Black political power may have been the most enduring consequence of the Civil Rights Revolution.
As you know, America and the Northwest have made great strides towards equal opportunity since the 1960s. but much work remains. Just as slavery left a legacy of segregation, segregation has left a legacy we still must confront, racism, which is built into our American society in ways that most white people do not recognize. In education, for example, lowered expectations can contribute to young people not being trained well enough to be employable. Our policing and justice systems at every level treat people of color more severely than whites. So we authors and our core generation challenge all of you and all of those who come to help correct these flaws in America. Together, joining with others, we can break the cycle of the low expectations and injustice that lead to lack of hope. Join the pledge. We all must aim for a nation that is indivisible with liberty and justice for all. As we say in the end of our book, we hope that this book will not only tell you how we were and what we did to become who we are now, but also to inspire all of us to work toward what we still could be, a world of equality.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.